You know that universal human experience where you're walking down a flight of stairs in the dark?
Oh, yeah. Always terrifying.
Right, and your brain is absolutely like 100% convinced there's one more step at the bottom.
Yep, you can feel it in your bones.
Exactly. So you step down and your foot hits absolutely nothing but air, and your entire body just jolts. Your stomach completely
It's
drops.
the worst. Your heart rate spikes instantly, and you physically flinch.
Right. Because your body was operating on a mental map that turned out to be completely wrong. I mean, your physical mechanics, the actual act of walking, were perfectly fine. You know how to walk.
Right, you've done it your whole life.
Yeah, but your spatial expectation, your unconscious assumption about exactly where you were in the physical world, it completely betrayed you.
And that terrifying jolt, that physical confusion.
That is exactly what happens when a hockey player gets moved from the wing to the center of the ice.
It really is.
And we are looking at a manual today that completely deconstructs this exact phenomenon. It's titled Switching Positions, Learning to Play the Game. And our mission for you, the listener, in this deep dive is to give you total mastery of positional transitions.
Because it's not just a physical thing.
No, not at all. We aren't just going to hand you a list of where to stand. We are going to build a comprehensive mental framework. We want you to understand exactly why players move the way they do, how highly specific rule books change based literally on where your skates are located, and most importantly, what habits you absolutely must destroy if you want to succeed.
That's the crucial theme we really have to establish right away. Moving positions in hockey is not about learning a new sport.
Unless you're moving into the net.
Well, yeah, the only exception is moving into the goaltender's crease, which is just a completely different universe that we will definitely explore later. But for skaters, it is entirely about adopting a new mental map. You're fundamentally replacing your location reflexes.
Okay, let's unpack this with an analogy. It is exactly like driving a car in a foreign country. Like if you move from the United States to the United Kingdom, the mechanical operation of the vehicle is exactly the same.
Right, the gas pedal still makes you go.
Yeah. You still know how to steer, how to apply the brake, how to accelerate on the ice. That is your skating and your puck handling.
But the environment is upside down.
Exactly. The road signs are different, the lanes are reversed, and your deeply ingrained subconscious instinct of where to look first when you pull into a busy intersection is suddenly deadly wrong. Your automatic reflexes are no longer keeping you safe. They are actively putting you in danger.
That is really the perfect way to visualize it. The vehicle is identical, but the environment's rules of engagement have completely inverted.
So let's start with the vehicle itself. What exactly transfers perfectly to the new position? Like, what do you get to keep?
Well, the good news is that your core mechanical toolkit comes with you. Almost all of your physical skills transfer completely intact.
Okay, so like skating, obviously.
First and foremost, skating. Every forward stride, every edge, every crossover, every tight turn you own, that all comes with you.
With one big exception, right?
Yeah, the one major exception is backward skating and pivoting, which is this massive, often insurmountable barrier for forwards moving to defense. But we'll dissect that specific nightmare later.
Sounds fun. What else?
Secondly, your ability to scan the ice transfers.
And scanning being the act of taking a mental picture of the rink before you actually physically touch the puck.
Precisely. Turning your head to build spatial awareness before the puck arrives is a universal skill. The source material references this really fascinating 2025 study by Berg and his colleagues.
Oh, the Swedish study.
Yeah, they analyzed over 2,000 puck resections by Swedish professionals. They actually tracked the player's eye movements and found that the physical act of scanning is identical regardless of position.
So a defenseman and a winger look at the ice the exact same way.
The visual processing mechanism is exactly the same. A defenseman looking for an outlet pass uses the exact same eye movements as a center looking for a shooting lane. It's just the targets of what you are searching for that change.
That makes a lot of sense. And puck protection works the same way, right?
Absolutely.
Like putting your body between the checker and the puck, maintaining a wide base, keeping your feet moving. Whether you are a defenseman shielding a puck behind your own net or a winger doing it on the half wall,
There.
the physics of leverage and balance just don't change.
Exactly. And the final piece is reading pressure. Knowing whether a checker has sealed your escape route along the boards or if they have, overcommitted and skated past your shoulder, that's a universal read. Oh, and of course, your general rules, knowledge offside, icing interference. That all remains the same.
Okay, so let me pose an active learning prompt for you, the listener. Think about this. If all these core skills, the skating, the scanning, the shielding, the reading pressure, if they all transfer perfectly, why do players look so utterly lost when they switch positions?
It's a great question.
I mean, they look like they have forgotten how to play the game entirely.
It goes right back to your dark staircase analogy.
Mm-hmm.
What you lose, instantly and completely, is that set of location reflexes.
Can you define location reflexes for us, specifically in a hockey context?
Sure. So a location reflex is an automatic subconscious action that's triggered by where the puck is and where you are on the ice. It is the raw instinct of where to look first, where to drift when the play moves away from you, and exactly which opposing player you were supposed to neutralize when the puck enters a specific zone.
And those aren't things you can learn overnight.
No, these reflexes take an entire season to build into your muscle memory. They are highly, highly position specific. So when they are stripped away, you are forced to consciously think about every single step you take.
And in hockey, thinking gets you killed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In a game as fast as ice hockey, thinking is agonizingly slow. That cognitive slowness is what makes a highly skilled player look completely lost.
Which brings us to the ultimate immediate hack to speed up this transition. The manual is incredibly clear on this. The most important thing a player can do before a switch isn't practicing a new technique, it's asking a system question.
Yes. The very first question in a new position must be about the team's overarching system.
Give us some examples.
Like, are we playing a zone defense or are we playing man-on-man in our own end? Which forecheck pattern are we running? What's my specific backcheck lane assignment?
Okay, let me push back on this a little bit because I am putting myself in the listener's skates right now. If I am a player stepping into a new role, say the coach just tapped me on the shoulder and told me I'm playing center tonight, and I immediately start bombarding the coach with basic systemic questions, isn't that going to backfire?
You'd think so, but no.
Doesn't that make me look incredibly inexperienced, like I lack hockey IQ? Wouldn't it be better to just watch the veterans on the team and quietly mimic what they're doing? Just, you know, fake it until you make it.
It is a very common fear, but it is a completely backward way of thinking. If you try to mimic the veterans in real time, you are reacting a full second late to every single play. A new player in a new position has an absolute unlimited license to ask these systemic questions.
Why is that?
Because these systems aren't universal laws of physics, right? They are subjective coaching choices. A low zone collapse is functionally and geometrically entirely different from a man-on-man defensive scheme.
So by not asking, I'm literally just guessing which playbook we're using.
Exactly. If you don't ask, you are going to default to a system your team might not even be playing. Failing to ask guarantees you will skate to the wrong place. And honestly, that makes you look vastly more incompetent than simply asking for the roadmap before you put the car in drive.
All right, you've convinced me. Ask for the map, don't guess. But here is where it gets really interesting. Let's say you have the map. You know the system perfectly. Why do you still fail?
Because of your habits.
Right. Because your old map is actively trying to hijack the car. The manual calls this the danger of good habits.
This is perhaps the most crucial conceptual hurdle in the entire manual. Your existing instincts are not neutral. If you, the listener, take away nothing else from this early discussion, remember this. The highly trained habits that made you a fantastic player in your old position are actively working to destroy you in your new one.
Because they are automatic. When the pressure hits, you don't rise to the occasion, you sink to the level of your training.
Precisely. Under extreme physical pressure, the prefrontal cortex, which is the thinking part of your brain, it just shuts down. You have zero time to consciously deliberate, so your central nervous system simply executes whatever reflex is most deeply grooved into your neural pathways.
And if that reflex belongs to a winger, but you're playing center,
you are going to make a catastrophic tactical error.
Let's actually map out these habit inversions for the listener, because the manual lays them out brilliantly. Visualize this. Let's start with a winger moving to center. A winger is taught strict lane discipline. Hold your side of the ice, stay wide against the boards, and whatever you do, do not chase the puck into the middle of the rink.
It's a fantastic, vital habit for a winger.
Right. But what happens when you take that perfectly trained winger and put them at center?
That disciplined lane holding immediately becomes fatal passivity.
Walk us through a scenario.
Okay, so when the puck gets jammed up in a battle in the defensive corner, the winger turned center will instinctively stay glued to the wall, or they'll drift up into the high slot. They will literally just stand there, watching their own defensemen fight a two-on-one battle in the corner that they are mathematically guaranteed to lose.
Because the center is supposed to be in there helping.
Exactly. The center's primary job in the defensive zone is low, immediate support. But their old winger instinct screams at them to stay away from the chaotic pileup.
Wow. They are literally doing what their brain thinks is the right thing, and it's completely destroying the team's defense.
Yeah, it's sabotage from the inside.
Let's reverse it. A center moving to wing. A center's entire psychological identity revolves around being the connective tissue of the play, right? They go to the puck, they support the puck carrier, they are always, always involved in the active decision.
And when you move that highly connective player to the wing, that instinct becomes their worst possible trait. Because they want to help, they will drift away from the boards and straight into the middle of the ice because, well, that's where the puck is.
And why is that bad for a winger to do?
Because when they do that, they collapse the entire line's offensive spacing. You absolutely need three forwards occupying three distinct wide lanes to stretch the opposing defensemen away from each other.
To make them cover more ground.
Right. If the winger drifts into the middle to help, two defenders can now easily cover all three forwards with minimal effort.
It's like a wide receiver in American football who is supposed to run a deep route along the sideline to stretch the field, but instead constantly runs slant routes into a crowded middle.
That's a great comparison.
They just bring the defenders right to the quarterback. Okay, what about a forward converting to defense? This one seems dangerous.
Oh, it is. A forward as primary directive, forged over thousands of shifts, is to attack the puck and win it back. It is this aggressive, forward-moving, hunting mindset.
They'll get the puck.
Exactly. When that forward converts to defense, that urge to hunt becomes a disastrous urge to chase. Both defensemen end up drawn like magnets to the puck in the corner, leaving the most dangerous real estate on the entire ice surface, the goal mouth directly in front of the net, completely empty.
Which is how you get scored on.
Yeah. The source manual notes that coaches at every single level point to this specific aggressive habit as one of the most common causes of totally preventable goals.
And the final inversion defense to forward. A defenseman is trained in the art of caution, right? Contain the rush, deny the middle, wait for the opponent to make a mistake, and never attack until you are 100% sure the play is safe.
Which is exactly how you ruin an offensive forecheck.
Yeah.
If a defenseman turned forward waits until a loose puck in the offensive zone is obviously safe to pursue, that window of opportunity has already slammed shut. The defense has already recovered.
So they just hesitate too much.
Their ingrained caution translates into a severe reluctance to attack open space. Suddenly, their forward line is effectively playing shorthanded. Furthermore, if they wait for someone else to initiate the attack, nobody does. The rule for forwards is whoever gets there first is the first man in. There is no waiting for permission.
So how do we actually fix this? Because just telling a player to try harder isn't going to magically rewrite a neural pathway.
What's fascinating here is the cognitive science behind unlearning. Unlearning a deeply grooved automatic behavior is actually much slower and significantly harder than learning a brand new behavior from scratch.
So practice isn't enough.
General, unspecific effort does not work. General effort just makes you skate faster in the wrong direction. The fix, according to experienced developmental coaches, is highly specific verbalization. You must literally name the old habit out loud before you ever step over the boards for your shift.
You mean literally talking to yourself on the bench?
Yes. Literally saying out loud, I'm going to feel uncomfortable going into that dirty corner to support my defenseman, but I'm going in anyway. Or my brain is going to want to drift into the high slot, but my lane is glued to the boards.
That's fascinating.
You have to consciously bring the flawed reflex into your active working memory so your prefrontal cortex can override it before the pressure hits.
Let's do a quick retrieval pause for you, the listener. What should we remember here? You should remember that your brain will absolutely betray you under pressure unless you consciously verbally identify the specific habit you are trying to break. Do not rely on vague effort. Rely on deliberate, spoken attention.
Exactly. And understanding that burden of unlearning transitions perfectly into the specific mechanics of moving from the wing to the center. The manual vividly calls this the burden of the middle.
Let's talk about the spatial shift, because this goes back to the idea of a mental map. We noted earlier that wingers have a defined home on the ice. In the defensive zone, a winger's home is typically high on the boards, covering the opposing defenseman at the blue line. It is a fixed point. But the center is basically completely homeless.
That is a great way to frame it. Under a low zone collapse, which is the defensive coverage this manual assumes as the standard for modern hockey, the center's geographic responsibility moves dynamically with the puck.
How does that look in practice?
Let's visualize a low zone collapse. Imagine a shrinking net around your own goaltender, pulling all the defending players inward to protect the most dangerous scoring areas. In this system, if the puck is low in the right corner, the center is low in the right corner, acting as the second man in to help the defenseman.
And if it moves?
If the puck moves up high to the blue line, the center must immediately retreat to the high slot to block shooting lanes. They have no static home. They are permanently tethered to the puck's location.
The cognitive load of that must be exhausting. You're constantly calculating geometry on the fly. And this brings us to a specific play called the swing low breakout. This is a massive spatial adjustment for a former winger. Walk us through the physical route a new center has to take when their team finally gets the puck back.
When your defenseman recovers the puck behind your own net, the center must immediately become the primary escape valve. To do this, they execute the swing low. This requires skating deep inside the faceoff dots and getting below the hash marks.
Let's quickly visualize the hash marks for anyone who might be fuzzy on the specific rink markings.
Sure, the hash marks are those short parallel lines painted on the outside of the large faceoff circles. Getting below them means getting very deep into your own zone, close to the goal line. The center has to carve a route deep into that strong side circle, which is the side of the ice where the puck currently is.
But why so deep? If I'm a former winger, my instinct is to just drift out to the sideboards and wait for a nice, easy pass. Why can't the center just hang out on the wall?
Because the wall is already occupied. That is the winger's territory. If the center lazily drifts out to the wall, they are now standing right next to their own winger. A single opposing forechecker can now cover both of them simultaneously with just one body.
Ah, right. The spacing issue again?
Exactly. By swinging low and staying inside the dots, the center gives the defenseman a crucial middle lane passing option. Now, the opposing defense has to respect two completely different, spatially separated escape routes.
But, and this goes right back to our earlier point about asking system questions. This low swing is highly specific to the conventional swing breakout, correct?
Absolutely. If your team plays a system called the center fly, where the center blows out of the defensive zone early right at the middle of the ice to stretch the defense, or if you play a flat breakout, the geometric rules change completely. You cannot assume the route. You have to ask your coach.
Okay, let's talk about the absolute elephant in the room for anyone moving to center, faceoffs. Most wingers have never taken a faceoff seriously in their entire lives. They might have taken one in a beer league when the center was in the penalty box, but that's about it.
And it is vital to understand that a faceoff is an entirely separate, closed, repeatable skill within the game of hockey. It is almost a mini game of its own.
Yeah, the manual has some crazy numbers on this.
It really does. It highlights a staggering statistic from the NHL's official data for the 2025-26 season. Among the 109 centers who took at least 500 draws, the win rates range from 62.1% at the absolute top to 39.7% at the bottom.
That is a 22-point spread on a task that happens dozens of times a game.
Yes, and a spread that wide on a closed skill action is not a matter of puck luck. It is entirely a product of biomechanics, technique, stance, grip, and just endless repetition.
Let's actually explain how a faceoff is won, because it's not just swinging your stick wildly at the puck.
No, it is about leverage and anticipation. It involves lowering your center of gravity so you cannot be easily pushed off the dot. Mm-hmm. It involves the choice of an overhand versus an underhand grip on your lower hand to generate more torque.
Right.
It involves reading the referee's hand to anticipate the exact millisecond the puck leaves their fingers. And often, it involves physically tying up the opposing center's stick rather than going directly for the puck, which allows your wingers to scoop it up. It responds heavily to dedicated practice.
But there is a massive safety and rule quirk here that new centers get completely blindsided by, and it could cost their team the game. The helmet-to-helmet rule. This completely blew my mind when I was reading the sources.
It is a critical shift in the modern game. Everyone is taught to get low on a face-off to maximize that leverage we just talked about, right? But how you get low matters immensely from a legal standpoint. IIHF Rule 76.7, which governs all international play and all ice hockey in the United Kingdom, specifically targets helmet-to-helmet contact before the puck is dropped. In the previous 2025-26 rulebook, if you leaned in aggressively and your helmet touched the other center's helmet, the linesman simply gave you a warning.
But the manual explicitly notes a severe change for the current 2026-27 season.
Severe is the right word. The 2026-27 IIHF edition deleted the warning entirely. The official situation handbook now dictates that the lines person must immediately eject the center that is responsible from the face-off dot.
No warning at all.
There is no warning. You are just thrown out of the circle, forcing a cold winger to take the draw. And it gets worse. If the lines person cannot determine which center initiated the contact, they eject both centers.
Wow.
Furthermore, Rule 76.7 still explicitly allows the referee to apply a discretionary 2-minute minor penalty for physical contact prior to the drop.
So you could literally take a 2-minute minor, putting your team shorthanded, just for leaning your head in too aggressively before the puck even hits the ice.
Precisely. But here is the critical philosophical insight the manual provides regarding this rule. Changing the penalty does not alter the physical geometry of the face-off dot.
What do you mean by that?
Well, even if you attempt to get low the safe way, by deeply bending your knees and dropping your hips rather than extending your head forward over the dot, your head is still going to be mere inches away from your opponent's head because you are both fighting for a tiny piece of real estate. The rule changes who gets punished, but it does not make the physical space any less cramped or safer.
Right. The bodies are still occupying the same tiny circle.
Exactly. As a new center, you have to be intensely, consciously aware of your head position in a way a winger never is.
Incredible detail. Okay. Before we leave the center position, let's debunk a massive coaching myth that has survived for decades. Every hockey coach on earth says, centers skate the most, they fade first, they need the absolute best cardiovascular conditioning on the team.
It is a half-truth that gets repeated as absolute gospel. The manual brings in empirical data to crush this, specifically the Lignell study, which tracked 36 NHL players via wearable sensors.
And what did they find?
The biometric data showed that defensemen actually covered 29% more total distance than forwards, and they were on the ice 47% longer per game.
Wait, I need to pause here. Defensemen skate further.
Yes, in terms of sheer raw distance covered over 60 minutes. However, the study also defined high-intensity skating, which is bursts of speed over a specific kilometer-per-hour threshold. The forwards perform 54% more high-intensity skating per minute than the defensemen.
Okay, that makes sense.
Right, the forward shifts are shorter, but they are incredibly explosive due to the start-stop nature of forechecking, whereas a defenseman does a lot more smooth gliding and gap control.
Now, the manual notes the study only splits forwards and defensemen. It doesn't explicitly separate centers from wingers.
Correct. But the defensible logical conclusion derived from the data is this. Centers do not necessarily cover more raw distance than wingers. What they actually do is work more of the ice.
Geographically speaking.
Exactly. A winger operates mostly in a vertical lane. A center plays the full width of the rink and navigates all three zones deeply. Navigating that much geography is incredibly taxing mentally and physically, meaning a new center will likely need to call for a line change much earlier than they were used to. But if someone tells you a center simply skates miles further than anyone else, the science just doesn't support it.
Okay, transitioning perfectly from that. Wait, no, I'm falling into the trap of just reading the outline. Let's follow the causal chain here. If the middle of the ice is that exhausting and geographically complex, moving to the outside must be incredibly simple, right? Just stand by the boards and wait for the puck. But the manual argues it is actually a completely different type of prison. Let's explore moving from center to wing. The manual calls this the spacing mandate.
We touched on this when discussing bad habits, but it deserves deep focus. A winger's lane is strictly the outside third of the ice. If you are a former center, the hardest thing in the world is to stay in that lane when the puck is 100 feet away on the opposite side of the rink.
You just want to chase it.
Your instinct screams at you to go help, but you must resist. The geometry of the sport demands it. Three forwards and three distinct lanes force the defense to stretch out and create passing seams. Three forwards in one lane get smothered.
And this brings us to one of the most frustrating pieces of hockey jargon, the duality of the term stay high. The manual points out that coaches yell this from the bench all the time, but it actually means two completely contradictory things depending on who has the puck. I can easily see how this ruins a new winger's confidence.
It is a severely overloaded term that causes immense confusion. Let's use an analogy of a pressure valve on a steam pipe. Defensively, when the opposing team has the puck in your zone, stay high means position yourself high in your defensive zone near the blue line, covering the opposing defenseman.
Okay.
Your job is to act as the cap on the pressure valve, staying between that defenseman and your own net, blocking their shooting lanes.
Right. You're containing the pressure. But what about when your team finally wins the puck back in the corner?
This is the massive aha moment for new wingers. The instruction to stay high expires the absolute microsecond your team wins that corner battle. The pressure valve must release. The moment your team secures possession, you must immediately drop down the wall. You move from the point down to the outlet spot on the boards, which is typically located right between the hash marks and the goal line.
But why drop down? Why not stay high and just wait for a long pass?
Because if you stay high at the point after your team wins the puck, your defenseman, who just won the brutal corner battle, has absolutely no one to pass to on the wall. The passing lane is completely blocked by bodies. By dropping down, you provide a short, safe outlet.
So you have to anticipate the win, get your feet moving, and drop down the wall before the pass is even made.
Yes, but with a terrifyingly strict caveat. You must watch the physical battle, not just the puck, and you absolutely do not leave the point until the battle is actually won.
Oh, because if you cheat early...
If you abandon your defensive coverage on the mere hope that your teammate is going to win the puck and they lose it, you have just given the opposing defenseman a wide-open point shot.
That is a razor-thin margin for error. Got it.
Now, let's talk about the face-off circle again. We just spent all that time talking about how hard the center has it, fighting for leverage and avoiding penalties. But apparently, as a winger, you can ruin the entire play without even moving your feet.
This is a rule that absolutely shocks formal centers when they move to the wing. When you are a winger, standing still on the hash marks during a draw, you are a lethal liability to your own center if you don't know the rule book. Let's examine Hockey Canada Rule 6.2A as a prime example.
Okay.
It states that if a player other than the center moves offside, physically touches the opponent, or encroaches into the circle before the puck drops.
What happens to the winger?
A penalty.
No. What happens is that the center gets kicked out of the dot.
Wait, I make a mistake on the hash marks and my center gets thrown out. They pay for my crime.
Exactly. You give away the draw and put your team at a massive disadvantage without ever touching the puck. And the triggers are incredibly strict. That middle clause making physical contact with an opponent, it doesn't even require crossing a painted line on the ice. If you lean over and put a glove or a shoulder on the opposing winger standing next to you before the puck leaves the referee's hand, your center is ejected.
Is that just Canada?
No, USA Hockey writes it slightly differently in Rule 613D, focusing on failing to maintain proper position. But the practical result on the ice is identical. As a new winger, your job is simple but absolute. Stand perfectly still, keep your stick on your own side of the hash marks, and keep your hands to yourself until you hear the puck hit the ice.
Okay, let's move from the technical rules to the physical realities. The most brutal part of a winger's job is battling for the puck on the boards. The manual lists two absolute non-negotiables for safety here. Listeners, if you take nothing else onto the ice, pay very close attention to this.
These aren't suggestions, they are survival rules. There are two cardinal sins on the boards. First, never turn your back. Second, never duck. These are prohibitions against two entirely different but equally catastrophic types of injuries.
Break down the biomechanics of why. Let's start with turning your back.
If you turn your back to the boards to receive a pass or to try and shield a puck with your body, any contact from an approaching checker immediately becomes a hit from behind. Because you are facing the glass, you cannot see the player coming, which means your brain cannot signal your muscles to physically brace for the impact.
And without bracing?
USA Hockey safety materials explicitly warn that even a remarkably light hit from behind, when a player is unbraced, can inflict severe spinal trauma by driving the player face first into the unforgiving boards.
The second sin, ducking, seems even more insidious because ducking is a natural human flinch reflex. When something comes at our head, we duck.
It is a deeply ingrained survival reflex off the ice, but on the ice, it is deadly. When a player ducks, they tuck their chin down toward their chest. Let's look at the anatomy of the neck. The cervical spine has a natural curve, a lordotic curve, that acts like a shock absorber. Mm-hmm. When you tuck your chin, you remove that curve, straightening the neck bones into a direct, rigid, vertical line.
And what happens if you take an impact in that posture?
If you suffer a head-first collision with the boards with a straightened cervical spine, the spine cannot absorb the energy. It compresses upon itself and fractures.
Wow.
The manual cites a landmark biomechanical study by Dr. Charles Tater, which USA Hockey relies upon heavily in its safety curriculum. Dr. Tater's research proved that this specific catastrophic cervical spine fracture does not require a high-speed, highlight reel collision. It could occur at walking speed.
Walking speed, that is absolutely terrifying. Just stumbling into the boards at 3 miles an hour can break your neck if your chin is tucked.
It is a sobering reality of the sport. The proper non-negotiable technique for board battles is absolute. Keep your skates parallel to the wall, take the physical contact on your padded forearm and hip, and keep your head up with your chin proudly off your chest. If you find yourself already facing the boards and you cannot turn sideways in time, put your stick and gloves up flat against the glass to distribute the kinetic force. But never, ever duck.
Okay, taking a deep breath after that. So we've survived the physical punishment of the wall. But what if you have to manage the entire length of the ice backwards? Let's explore moving from forward to defense. This is described as the largest systemic change available in hockey without putting on goalie pads. And the manual states bluntly that the initial barrier here is entirely technical, not tactical.
Yes. Forwards converting to defense often arrogantly think they just need to memorize the defensive playbook and they will be fine. But their actual performance ceiling is dictated entirely by one sheer physical skill backward skating.
Just the mechanics of it.
Specifically, the concept of gap control, which is the ability to maintain a tight, suffocating distance between yourself and an oncoming puck carrier, that is purely a backward skating physics problem.
Because if you can't skate backwards fast enough to match their forward speed,
you have exactly two choices, and they are both terrible. Choice one, you realize you are too slow, so you panic and pivot early to skate forward to keep up. But the moment you pivot, the attacker can beat you with a single, simple change of direction because your momentum is locked.
And choice two.
Choice two, you leave a massive 15-foot gap so you don't get beat, and the attacker just comfortably walks the puck right into your defensive zone and sets up a play.
This highlights a tragic reality for new defensemen that the manual points out. Your skating failures are constantly going to be falsely graded by your coaches as decision failures.
Exactly. The coach will scream, "You made a bad read. Why did you back off so far?" When really, your brain made the right read, but your feet just physically couldn't execute it.
So you can't just fix it in the film room.
No. The fix isn't watching more film. The fix is booking a power skating session. You have to master the backward C cut, which isn't just running backward, it's violently carving the ice with the front half of your blade. And you have to master backward crossovers to generate lateral speed.
And you have to drill pivots in both directions, right? Because the manual notes that coaches default to teaching players to pivot toward the boards.
Yes, coaches teach the board side pivot, because if you stumble and get beat, you get beat to the outside, away from the net. But that is a coaching preference born of risk aversion, not a law of physics. Sometimes the attacker's route dictates that you must execute a middle pivot to maintain leverage. You have to be equally competent turning both ways, or you will be exploited.
Speaking of getting beat to the outside, we have to clear up a massive misconception that drives new defensemen absolutely crazy. The difference between forcing them outside versus getting beaten wide.
This is a brilliant distinction in the text. New defensemen hear a coach yell, "Force them outside," and they think their job is to physically prevent the attacker from ever reaching the outer lane of the ice. But unless you are twice as fast as the attacker, that is impossible.
So what does it actually mean?
Forcing them outside is like leading a partner in a dance. You are angling your body and skating a route that confidently occupies and shuts down the middle of the ice. You steer the attacker toward the boards by making the middle unavailable. The critical geometric element is this. While they are on the outside, you are still physically located between the attacker and the net.
Right. You are inside of them, goal side. You haven't lost the leverage.
Exactly. Getting beaten wide, on the other hand, means the attacker has accelerated past your outside shoulder. You are no longer between them and the net. The dance is over. There's open ice behind you, and they can cut directly to the goal whenever they please.
Okay, I think I understand the geometry, but here's where I get confused and where I think a lot of players get into penalty trouble. If I successfully angle them to the boards, why can't I just hit them? The manual says the angle is yours, the contact often is not. Let's dive deep into the legalities of the wall, because it seems like the rule book changes wildly depending on where you live.
This is exactly where players rack up penalty minutes, because they don't understand the philosophy of their specific governing body. Steering a player to the outside by occupying space is legal everywhere. Hockey Canada, for example, explicitly states a player may steer an opponent into the boards without actually touching them. But, and this is a massive but, that permission only exists as long as you do not bump, push, or shove the opponent.
Wait, bumping is illegal. This is ice hockey.
In many classifications, yes, it absolutely is. Let's look at the philosophy of USA Hockey. Rule 604 prohibits body checking entirely in 12 and under youth leagues, all female classifications, and all non-Czech adult leagues. Their philosophy at the youth level is about preventing brain trauma in developing bodies and focusing on skill development.
So no checking at all.
And that rule book is just the floor. Local municipal bodies can ban checking in even older age groups. If you were in a non-checking league, riding a player into the wall with your body is a penalty. Full stop.
What about the rules in the United Kingdom? The manual mentions British women's hockey specifically. Imagine you are a player in London. What are you dealing with?
In the UK, you are governed by IIHF rules. IIHF Rule 101.1 for women's hockey has a very nuanced philosophy. It allows body checking if there's a clear, obvious intention to play the puck. It recognizes that hockey is a contact sport.
Okay, so hitting is allowed.
However, it explicitly carves out the boards as a danger zone. Players are strictly forbidden from using the boards to eliminate, push, or pin an opponent.
So I can check them in open ice, but not on the wall.
Correct. You can hold your ground on the wall. But if you step or glide into an opposing player specifically to pin them against the boards, it is an illegal hit, which carries at least a minor penalty. And here is the kicker for British women's hockey. Any major penalty automatically carries a game misconduct ejection. The margin for error is zero.
Wow. And what if I play in an adult recreational league, say, under CARA rules in Canada?
CARA Rule 49A reverses the burden of contact completely. The philosophy here is that these are adults who have to go to work on Monday morning. You actually have an affirmative duty to avert body contact.
Avert it entirely.
Yes. The rule assesses penalties for intentionally standing in front of an opponent to force contact. So that angling technique we just discussed can easily cross the line into an interference or roughing penalty if the referee believes you aren't actively trying to avoid the final collision.
Okay, but let's say I am playing in a full contact, highly competitive checking league, high level junior or the NHL. Can I just obliterate the guy on the wall if I catch him?
Absolutely not. This is a lethal misconception. The fact that the puck carrier sees you coming does not give you a license to board them. A lot of players falsely believe boarding only applies if the victim is hit from behind or is completely defenseless. But USA Hockey Rule 603 doesn't even use the word defenseless in its base definition. Boarding is defined as pushing or checking an opponent dangerously into the boards, period.
So it's about the violence of the impact into the boards themselves.
Exactly. Furthermore, the NHL, IIHF, and Hockey Canada rulebooks all specifically cite unnecessary contact on a player who is chasing down an icing or offside play as boarding. A player skating full speed after an iced puck is fully aware of their surroundings, but hitting them unnecessarily into the wall is still boarding. The onus of safety is always, always on the player delivering the check.
Let's layer in the actual geography of the rink itself, because the manual points out that ice width completely changes how you defend the rush.
Yes. The geometry of the rink dictates your tactics. On a wide international size sheet, typically 100 feet wide, if you force a puck carrier outside, they still have plenty of room to operate and make a pass. Your gap control and your stick positioning become paramount because the wall is too far away to help you. But on a narrow rink, the wall acts as your second defender much faster.
And we can't assume we know our rink size just by reading the rule book on our league's website, right?
No, and the manual warns British players specifically about this trap. People assume that because they play under IIHF rules, they are playing on a massive wide Olympic sheet. But IIHF Rule 1.2 actually allows rinks starting at 26 meters wide, which is roughly 85 feet, basically the same width as an NHL rink.
So they aren't all massive.
Right. Furthermore, the UK's specific in-house rules authorize rinks that are even smaller than the IIHF minimums for almost all levels of domestic play. You have to literally measure the building you are playing in. On a narrow UK rink, steering someone outside limits their options incredibly quickly. You must adjust your angling accordingly.
Fascinating. Now, beyond the physical contact rules and the rink geometry, a new defenseman is suddenly exposed to completely new administrative rules that forwards never worry about. Let's talk about the puck over the glass penalty.
This is a classic heartbreaking rookie defenseman mistake. You're under immense forechecking pressure deep in your own zone. You try to clear the puck high off the safety glass to get out of the zone, but your blade angle is wrong and you miss the glass. The puck sails directly out of play into the netting or the crowd.
And that's an automatic penalty, right?
Under NHL Rule 63.2 and under IIHF rules, that is a strict, non-negotiable 2-minute minor penalty for delay of game. It does not matter if it was a total accident.
But that's not true everywhere, right?
Correct. This is where reading your specific local rule book saves you from panicking. USA Hockey and Hockey Canada philosophies generally only assess a penalty if the referee believes the puck was shot out deliberately to kill the play.
So what happens if it's an accident?
Under USA Hockey, an accidental shootout just results in a face-off. Hockey Canada does the same for minor hockey, though in junior and senior divisions, they add a punitive quirk. There is no penalty time, but the defending team that shot the puck out is not allowed to make a line change. They must stay on the ice tired.
Which brings us to the most common everyday issue for a new defenseman, icing the puck.
When a new defenseman panics, they just hammer the puck down the ice. It goes all the way down, the whistle blows for icing, and the faceoff comes all the way back deep into your defensive zone. Under NHL and IIHF rules, the team that iced the puck is forbidden from substituting players. You are trapped on the ice, exhausted, and the opposing team gets to put out fresh offensive players. And to make it worse, the rules prohibit you from taking your time out to rest.
Unless there's an injury, right?
Yes, a genuine injury or a broken skate blade is the only exception for the line change ban. But again, the rule books diverge wildly here. USA Hockey imposes neither of those restrictions at the amateur level. If you ice the puck under USA Hockey rules, you can change your players freely and you can take a timeout.
That's a huge difference.
It fundamentally changes the risk-reward calculation of blindly icing the puck to relieve pressure. Under USA Hockey, it's a valid escape hatch. Under IIHF, it's a trap.
Okay, we are seeing how defensive transitions are bound by strict rules. But what if we flip that entire mindset? Let's look at moving from defense to forward.
If we connect this specific transition to the bigger picture of how hockey is played, moving from defense to forward requires a complete violent inversion of your psychological profile. Defensemen is fundamentally built to deny space. They close gaps, they occupy dangerous passing seams, and they take options away from the opponent.
And a forward?
A forward's entire job is to attack empty space. You have to find the ice that nobody is currently defending, arrive in it at the exact right moment, and force the defense to make a difficult decision.
The manual points out a fatal flaw here, that former defensemen will wait until a play looks obviously safe before they move into that open ice.
Exactly, because caution and patience have been heavily rewarded for their entire career. But for a forward, the moment the play is obviously safe, the window of opportunity has already closed. The defense has recovered their structure. You have to anticipate the play and attack the space before it is fully secured. You have to live with risk.
Let's hit a quick, vital technical rule for forwards that defensemen rarely think about. Offside, specifically timing your zone entry at the blue line.
The offside rule is actually slightly more generous than many casual players think. You are only considered offside when both of your skates have completely crossed the blue line before the puck does. So, dragging a trailing skate behind you keeps you legally onside.
But here is the million-dollar question. Does that trailing skate have to physically touch the ice?
Another massive rulebook divergence that changes your body mechanics. Under NHL and IIHF rules, your trailing skate can be hovering in the air over the blue line or the neutral zone, and you are considered onside. This allows for very dynamic leaning entries, but under USA Hockey Rule 630A and Hockey Canada Rule 6.11, the skate must physically touch the ice.
Really?
Yeah, if you lift your back foot an inch off the ice in a USA hockey game, the whistle blows. The play is dead.
It's insane how a tiny detail like keeping a blade on the ice completely changes your stride mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's address the most dramatic switch of all, anyone converting to goaltender.
The manual is incredibly blunt here, and rightfully so. This isn't a position switch. It is an entirely different sport that just happens to share the same sheet of ice.
But what if I just want to try it out? Can't I just throw on the pads for the third period of a blowout game to see how it feels?
Legally, in most competitive leagues, you literally cannot. The rule books are highly restrictive about goalie equipment for safety reasons. Skater helmets are not designed to take 90-mile-per-hour puck impacts directly to the face, and skater skates have exposed toes that will get shattered by a slap shot.
So they just ban it.
Therefore, NHL Rule 5.3 states that no skater is permitted to wear goalkeeper equipment unless both rostered goalkeepers are incapacitated. USA Hockey Rule 203 operates on the exact same philosophy. All rostered goalies must be legitimately hurt before a skater can gear up. Hockey Canada is even stricter. Their rulebook writes no incapacity exception at all. If your goalies are hurt, the game's likely over.
What about the IIHF? Are they as strict?
The IIHF is actually the lone outlier here. Their base rulebook doesn't contain this explicit prohibition against skaters wearing goalie gear, and their situation handbook actually outlines protocols for dressing a skater as a goalie if everyone else is injured, allowing the referee to give a reasonable amount of time to change gear. But for North American players, you can't just borrow gear mid-game on a whim.
Let's talk about neck protection, because this is a massive, highly scrutinized safety issue right now, with highly specific regional rules.
Yes, the rules are deeply fragmented. If you are playing anywhere in the UK, England, Wales, Scotland, or Northern Ireland, neck laceration protectors are absolutely mandatory for everyone. All players at all ages, including adults.
No exception.
None. The Ice Hockey UK in-house rule 9.12 is merciless on this. There are no warnings. If you step on the ice without one, the first offense is an immediate 10-minute misconduct penalty. In England and Wales, this strict enforcement applies to practice sessions as well as official games.
And how does that compare to North America?
It's much more patchwork. USA Hockey requires HECC-certified neck guards for all youth ages. But for adults, it is surprisingly only recommended, not required. Hockey Canada requires B&Q-certified guards for all minor and female hockey. And for goalies specifically, Hockey Canada notes a crucial equipment detail. A plastic dangler hanging off the bottom of your goalie mask is not enough to satisfy the rule. You must wear a certified fabric throw collar tightly underneath it.
What if a rostered goalie decides they want to do the reverse? Like, they're bored in net and want to skate out as a forward for a shift.
It's not just a matter of tossing off the pads and grabbing a player's stick. USA Hockey Casebook Situation 6 addresses this explicitly. It states that once you are designated on the official roster as a goalie, you cannot participate as a skater unless you are formally added to the score sheet as a skater before the play.
So you can't just sneak out there.
Right. And if you attempt to do it mid-game without telling anyone, your team is assessed a bench minor penalty. It's a bureaucratic nightmare designed to prevent exactly that kind of chaos.
Okay, we are rounding out our deep dive with one more highly specific geographic shift we haven't covered. Let's talk about the off wing. A right-handed shot playing left wing, or vice versa. What is the fundamental benefit of this?
The primary benefit is offensive geometry. When you enter the offensive zone on your off wing, the blade of your stick is naturally oriented toward the center of the ice, rather than facing the sideboards. This opens up vastly better passing angles to the slot, and it provides a vastly superior angle for a forehand shot from the prime scoring areas in the middle of the ice.
It's just a better setup for scoring.
It increases your offensive threat exponentially. It's exactly why power play units almost always position off-wing players on the half wall to set up dangerous one-timers.
But you have to pay a toll for that offense, and the cost is paid deep in your own defensive zone.
Yes, a heavy cost. When your defenseman tries to break the puck out of your zone by passing it hard up the boards, that pass now arrives on your backhand. Catching a hard pass on your backhand while moving forward is biomechanically awkward. It takes an extra split second to control, and it severely limits your ability to make a strong, immediate next play up the ice.
So how do we fix it? The manual walks through the perfect technique to solve this backhand problem.
You have to receive the puck open to the ice. Instead of keeping your hips parallel to the boards like you normally would, you must deliberately open your torso and your hips toward the center of the rink, and you must physically take one or two strides off the wall toward the middle.
Why step off the wall?
Because that physical separation gives you tactical options. By being a few feet off the wall and having your body open to the entire sheet of ice, you can skate forward with the puck, you can pass it to your center supporting low, you can pass it safely back to your defenseman, or you can attack the middle aggressively.
And if you don't?
If you stay pinned flush against the boards and try to catch it on your backhand, your body blocks your own vision, and you have exactly zero options. You are a sitting duck for a forechecker.
Now, you noted a conflicting source here in our research stack that could get someone hurt.
Yes, and this is why critical reading is essential. The Yukari, the adult hockey material, actually advises players to turn their back to the boards to receive this awkward backhand pass. But our primary masterclass manual emphatically rejects this advice.
And it rejects it based on the exact wall safety rules we discussed earlier.
Exactly. Never turn your back to the boards. If a forechecker arrives precisely as you receive that pass with your back turned, you're going to take a blind hit from behind. And as we learned from Dr. Tater's biomechanical studies, that is how severe cervical spine injuries happen. You must keep your skates parallel, take the contact on your forearm and hip, and keep your head up. No clean pass reception is worth risking a spinal injury.
Let's finish with the psychology of switching, the timeline. How long does this agonizing transition actually take?
While there is no published peer-reviewed biometric data on the exact psychological timeline, the coaching consensus is remarkably uniform. It takes a few difficult shifts just to stop feeling completely lost regarding where to physically stand. It takes a handful of full games before your routine reads, knowing instinctively who to cover dynamically as the puck moves become automatic. And it takes a full demanding season before the new position truly feels like home.
So there is a guaranteed performance dip.
A massive, unavoidable one. You will absolutely play worse before you play better. Your location reflexes are broken, and your new ones haven't formed. The classic rookie error is panicking and abandoning the switch in week 3, which is usually the absolute bottom of the performance dip. You have to push through the discomfort.
And if you actively want to switch, how do you successfully communicate that to the coach without sounding demanding?
It comes down to timing and specificity. Do not ask on the bench during a game. Emotions are too high. Ask a day or two later in private. And do not ask a vague, unhelpful question like, "Can I play center?" Ask a metric-driven question. "Coach, what specific skills do I need to demonstrate to get a look at center?" Then ask to try it in practice first, because practice costs the coach nothing in the standings.
And what if you are moved against your will?
You must separate the message from the delivery. The coach might be blunt, but the move isn't usually a punishment. Often, moving a forward back to defense means the coach trusts your hockey IQ immensely with the puck in your own end. Don't sulk. And whatever you do, don't try to prove you belong in your old position by intentionally playing the new one terribly. That just makes a temporary experiment look like permanent incompetence.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground, synthesized this massive amount of technical, physical, and psychological information into a final mental model for the listener. How should they organize this in their mind?
Switching positions in hockey is fundamentally an exercise in unlearning. You are overriding automatic, deeply grooved location reflexes and replacing them with conscious, system-driven decisions. And you are doing all of this while navigating highly specific, localized rule books regarding physical contact, ice geography, and equipment safety. It is a cognitive puzzle as much as a physical challenge.
Let's run through our final mastery review. Listeners, if you want to truly retain this, lock these concepts together. First, remember that your old good habits are your new worst enemies. You have to name them out loud to break their subconscious hold on you.
That's a huge one.
Second, always ask for the system map before you drive. Zone or man-on-man? Don't guess. Third, new centers. You must master the geometry of the swing-low breakout. Get below those hash marks and don't crowd your winger on the wall.
Right, preserve the spacing.
Fourth, respect the face-off dot. The IIHF will eject you for helmet-to-helmet contact, so manage your physical space carefully. Fifth, new wingers, you are the pressure valve. Get off the point the exact microsecond the puck is won and stay absolutely still on the hash marks during a draw so you don't get your center ejected.
Adding to that framework, your sixth pillar is absolute wall safety. Mm-hmm. Never turn your back, never duck. Remember, the biomechanics walking speed ducking injuries can break your neck. Seventh, new defensemen must realize that gap control is purely a backward skating metric. Fix your skating, and your tactical gaps will fix themselves. Eighth, forcing outside means staying between the attacker and the net, like a dancer leading a partner. The angle is yours, but the right to initiate contact heavily depends on whether you are bound by USA Hockey, Hockey Canada, or UK rules.
Right, read the rule book.
Ninth, new forwards must attack open space. If you wait for the play to look 100% safe, the space is already gone. And finally, goaltending is a legal and physical anomaly. Skaters cannot just swap gear, and the rule book takes no prisoners when it comes to incapacity rules and neck guards.
Unbelievable depth. We have torn this positional manual down to the absolute studs and rebuilt it. But before we go, I want to leave you, the listener, with a broader concept to ponder. We've spent this entire masterclass talking about location reflexes on the ice, doing the wrong thing automatically simply because of where you used to stand.
It's a powerful concept.
It is. I want you to look at your own life. How much of your professional career or even your personal relationships is dictated by outdated location reflexes? Are you reacting to a situation today using muscle memory from a job you left 5 years ago? What old, perfectly good habit is currently causing you to play your current role entirely wrong? Think about that phantom step on the dark staircase we talked about at the beginning. Where are you stepping into thin air because your mental map hasn't updated to your new reality?
That is the ultimate question of unlearning, both on and off the ice.
Thank you for joining us on this incredibly deep dive. Take these mental models, apply them to your game, and apply them to your life. We'll see you next time.